The Irish-American novelist Joseph O'Neill is best known for his book Netherland, about life in London and New York City after 9/11. Now O'Neill is out with a collection of short stories, Good Trouble. The stories, all previously published in The New Yorker and Harper's, bring readers into the inner lives of men in trouble. They're in trouble with their wives, their colleagues, their landlords, but mostly with themselves. O'Neill's masterful writing has been compared to Henry James and Vladimir Nabokov, been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, and won the Penn Faulkner Award. And I'm delighted that he's here with us today. Joseph, welcome.
Hi, DW. Good to be here.
So I think of you primarily as a novelist. What made you pivot to short fiction? Do you always have short fiction sort of on a second burner while the novels inch forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think I used to do that. I mean, these stories only began to get written in the early 2000s. And I would say that, you know, to begin with, they were things I did between writing novels. But I feel like in the last year or three, I've really sort of taken to the form, and it's no longer on the back burner.
What seduced you? What's pulled you in this direction?
Well, excuse me. I mean, well, it's not any sort of enormous sort of, you know, revelation about the superiority of short fiction. I think it's more that it's just what you find yourself writing. And I mean, I've had this novel, which I'm supposed to be trying to write for some time now, and I just found that my attention kept wandering to these smaller ideas, and they kept demanding to be written. And so that's what you do. You don't second guess that kind of gift, I suppose.
You were a lawyer in a former life, right?
Yeah, right, that's right. Yeah.
So when did you start devoting yourself full time to writing and make that transition?
Well, I combined or tried to combine the legal stuff with the writing stuff for about 15 years, and then that's when I came to the States. I came to the States temporarily, so I thought, in 98, and the idea was to finish a book and then go back to the law in London.
Best and, laid plans.
Sorry, yeah, it wasn't a very well laid plan. But then I sort of fell in love with New York and you know, and just stayed. And that entailed giving up, I suppose, the law in gradually. I mean, I didn't quite, you know, decide to sort of just quit. I sort of gradually found that I'd left it behind me.
It goes without saying that writers have a very certain relationship to language, but lawyers do too. I mean, lawyers have a very, very certain relationship to language. Has that been, has sort of your relationship to language as a lawyer informed your relationship as a writer to language, or has it been a divorce of some kind?
Yeah, I mean, lawyers are in love with language, and they sort of have to be. They have to be extremely sort of invested in the meaning of every single word that they use. I mean, that if you're a writer, that can be hazardous as well as helpful, because, you know, the lawyers, there are certain cliches and sort of, you know, formulas that lawyers use. But I do feel like it's had a big impact on my sentences, and more fundamentally on this idea that, you know, every sentence should logically develop, if not necessarily the previous sentence, but the story you're telling, so that it is a good training for sort of testing the slightly dreamy things you come up with against, you know, against this idea that there should be some sort of kind of logic to what you're writing as well, even if it is dream logic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like a pairing exercise between sort of that more imaginative work and giving things structure and giving things form.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about some of the stories in this collection. You said that one of the stories, The Poltroon Husband, takes its inspiration from Henry James. Explain this.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine, Philip Horn, an English guy, is one of the leading Jamesians, Henry James scholars, on the planet. And he was editing. He actually ran into a whole sort of cache or treasure, or whatever you want to call it, of story ideas that Henry James had written down And he had the idea to ask some writers to see if they could use those, choose a story idea and then try and write one up. And so that's what I did with The Poultry and Husband. It sort of concerned, I think the original was some, you know, someone in the 19th century who told the story over dinner to Henry James or to one of his friends that, you know, this husband had heard some noises in the night, and in fact it was the wife in the end who mustered the courage to go downstairs and find out what it was. And Henry James said that in his notes, they said, I couldn't possibly write this from the point of view of the husband. It's the sort of cowardice and would just make him too unspeakable a character. But I did. I wrote it from the point of view of the poltroon. That's his word. The utter poltroon, I think, is the phrase Henry James used. And because I was interested in, you know, in what that sort of fearfulness or cowardice might involve.
I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Joseph O'Neill about his new collection, Good Trouble, published by Pantheon Books. The first story in the collection follows a poet who resents Bob Dylan for winning the Nobel Prize in Literature. And you write, the ultra-celebrated multimillionaire who deals in concerts and extra-paginal iconicity is not playing the same game as a writer who sits down in a small college town and with no prospect of meaningful financial reward, tries to come up with a handful of words that will, unless something untoward should happen, be read by a maximum of 140 people. So is this the lonely life of most poets, or what generated that sort of point of view for this guy?
As it happens, the first writing I ever did was poetry. So I have a sort of fundamental kind of interest in that form and in poetry and poets, a familiarity with it, I suppose. I highly sympathize with poets in general. And I remember thinking when the Bob Dylan announcement was made,
right,
and there was a bit of a sort of, you know, uproar about it, that the people who were really sort of, I suppose, got the slap in the face or felt they'd been slapped in the face. And, you could see it online, too, in the discussions between poets. You know, some of them were sort of celebrating it or pretending to celebrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And others were sort of, frankly, sort of demoralized by the whole business, because Bob Dylan had been called a poet.
Right.
He hadn't been called a singer-songwriter who gets the Nobel. He'd been called a poet. And from the point of view of these practitioners, you know, the stuff he writes, you know, works in a song, mm-hmm, very well. But, you know, just obviously wouldn't work
if you just, on its own.
On its own, yeah. And it didn't take me away. And I had fun with the idea. I had a lot of sympathy for this kind of minute anger. And I also saw the sort of predicament of the poet who can't be seen, who can't be heard, to have a political resonance. In other words, I wrote this This was my weird way of responding to the election in 2016, because I think that so many people felt that an intelligent or meaningful or factually well-based pronouncement simply had no more weight in the culture,
right,
and that a certain level of fame and bluster somehow dominated now and sort of extinguished other voices. And I sort of felt that in some way, you know, we're all poets now.
Right. Yeah, that idea of fame sort of pushing all other attributes out or to the margins, I think definitely stands out in that story. And it's interesting to hear it in the context of the 2016 election. So most of your characters are very thoughtful, contemplative men. Is it fair to say that many of them are unhappy men?
But I just want to say there are a number of women protagonists in this.
Yes.
In this. In fact, I would say that I think a third of the stories are from the point of view of women. So it's, I'm not a sort of purely masculine writer. It's fair to say that they are sort of agitated by the tribulations of, in the case of these particular characters, not necessarily the characters in my novels, in the case of these story characters, they are agitated by the tribulations of bourgeois life. And, for me, the bourgeoisie, the sort of I suppose, what you would call the liberal middle class. You know, most people listening to the show would fall into that category. Are very interesting to me at the moment, partly for political reasons.
Right. Yeah. How do you write about unpleasant characters and still get the reader to care? Talk about sort of that balance.
Well, I mean, for example, I think the reader takes his or her cue from, you know, the sort of the sympathies of the writer, and it doesn't always work in a strange way. I mean, if you sort of like, for example, I would sympathize with the poet character who's furious and is, you know, and feeling futile about Bob Dylan, but at the same time, I would also withdraw my sympathy from him too. And I feel like, you know, it's actually, you can't actually control very easily the sympathies of the reader. I think you have to go, because often if you're very sympathetic towards a character, the reader will perversely and in a contrarian kind of way sort of turn against that particular character. Mm-hmm. And I actually find that when I write a character who I think is sympathetic, I then notice that other readers find this character very unsympathetic. Hmm. So it's almost as if it's quite hard to gain the sympathy of the reader.
So Rob Carlson is a character that stands out, pertains to this conversation here. He's trying to get a reference letter for a co-op rental application and mm-hmm. is struggling to do so. There's something sort of pathetic but also endearing about that experience. How does he fit into this sort of Rubicon you're talking about? Did you sympathize with him?
Yeah, I did. Although, you know, and then people thought this guy must be a monster for not being able to get personal references for his co-op. Whereas, in fact, he's just moved back to New York. He doesn't really know very, very many people. And, in fact, the people who are sort of withholding character references from him seem to me to be the ones who are, you know, not to be sympathized with. But it's amazing how people, I mean, and readers, I should say, sympathize with popularity. So if you make somebody who's obviously kind of popular with everybody, then people naturally assume that, start rooting for that character. Whereas if you sort of put someone who's in difficulty, in this case a guy who can't, for whatever reason, muster two personal references for his co-op board, then people sort of assume that there's obviously something wrong with him, even though there's lots of evidence from his, because he's telling the story, that maybe he's not such a bad guy.
Right.
He's just a regular guy.
Yeah, which definitely comes across at the very tail end of that story, where we see some very earnest exposure to his life. So there's not much reciprocity or intimacy in the friendships we see in Good Trouble. Why is friendship so hard for your characters, do you think?
I think friendship is quite hard. You know, especially friendship exposed to the duration of time. I mean, I think we have friends at certain moments. Most, you know, and we see that in this particular collection. We have friendships forged in college, and then years intervene. You know, marriages intervene, jobs intervene, and suddenly the sort of basis for those friendships becomes tested, and out of date, as it were. And I do think that, and I don't think I just from my own observation, that it requires, you know, that friendship isn't something that you can, you know, count on to remain stable. It's like everything else, that it needs constant nourishment.
Well, I think no matter how we describe the characters in the collection, contemplative, unhappy, troubles with their friendships, I can say certainly that they are human and very relatable. And it's a fantastic collection. I'm so grateful you came to discuss it with me today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, D.W. Thanks for having me on.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Joseph O'Neill about his new book of short stories titled Good Trouble, out from Pantheon Books.